This is Sports Talk with Earl Robinson from AM 870 WKAR. This program content is made possible in part by WKAR listeners.
This program is pre-recorded. Please do not call in. A very Merry Christmas and a very Happy New Year to each and every one, and we hope that you have a great holiday season. Jack Ebling is with me here. We're going to discuss last year's football team and last year's basketball team. And Jack, very interesting year last year in both sports, in basketball and football, especially in football. We were very disappointed in the 6-6 year. What went wrong, do you think, went wrong? I mean, Is it safe to say that you can say that it went wrong just because they lost so many close games?
Well, that was the result. That isn't what caused it. Losing a close game didn't necessarily cause them to lose the next close game. But there were so many factors put together. It's almost never one thing when people say what went wrong. You can't isolate one factor in a team sport like football. If the defense had made a couple more plays late in the game, if the offense had made a couple more big plays, if the special teams had come through the way they should have, you come down to five games decided by a total of 13 points, and it's a razor-thin margin between victory and defeat. And Michigan State was on the wrong side of that equation, just as they were on the right side the previous 2 years.
Yes, and we know that the offense maybe was a little bit too much on the wrong side this year. I mean, Maxwell just didn't show as much as we thought we would, but you know, he was a little bit of a disappointment, but he wasn't the whole thing. That's the thing. He wasn't the main problem with the offense. We know the receivers dropped balls. Sometimes the offensive line, when they got healthy, they were very good, but they were weren't healthy all the time. So they had a lot of problems though that you could say contributed to Michigan State's 6-6 season.
Football is a team game, Earl. You win as a team and you lose as a team. And this offensive unit, besides losing some key players, you talk about Kirk Cousins and B.J. Cunningham, Keyshawn Martin, Keith Nichol, Joel Foreman. They lost some players who were very reliable and experienced performers for them. But I think you have to start with the offensive line, with the injuries, the fact that they had seven different offensive lines in the first nine games. Think about that. Offensive line play requires so much cohesion and timing, and you have new players coming in and out of the lineup. Seven different units by midway through the Big Ten season. That's going to be a problem for anyone. And I think when you have receivers who are all new, who aren't necessarily running the best routes, who aren't catching the ball, I think Michigan State led the country in drop passes. That hurt. And then you have a quarterback who wasn't able to buy time, maybe the way some people thought he would, wasn't making the greatest decisions. And I think one of the problems Andrew had was throwing the ball at one speed. He wasn't throwing as catchable a ball as Kirk Cousins did. He'd take something off when he had to. He could zip it in there when he needed to, but he could put a little air under the ball. And I don't think Maxwell's ball was as catchable as it needed to be. So you put all those things together. There wasn't a second running back to take some of the pressure off Le'Veon Bell. And even though he got stronger in some games toward the end, that's still a lot of pounding, 350 carries. Plus, he was a receiver for him. Very difficult challenge he had, and they came up a couple of plays short.
Yes, they did. And that's what we saw, Jack, with Le'Veon. Unfortunate for him, he had to carry the load. He just didn't have any help this year.
A lot of people blame that on the offensive coordinator. Everyone thinks they're an offensive coordinator. That's one of the jobs. If you sit out in the stands, not where we are in the press box, although we get a lot of that too, but you sit out in the stands and, there are 60,000 suggestions as to what play you should run. And, of course, after the play, everyone knows what the play should have been.
Right.
So it's a little bit different if you're working with the clock up in the booth and you've got some personnel limitations. But I don't know that the play calling necessarily helped them this year. I think it probably hurt them in some cases, and that was just a contributing factor to an offense that wasn't good enough.
Exactly, because, I just looked at it all year long was that, we had the same offensive coordinator last year won 11 games, and he couldn't have got worse in 1 year.
He didn't take stupid pills.
Right.
No. So I think that Michigan State's offense was disappointing for most of the year. The defense was supposed to be one of the best in the country. It was a good defense, sometimes a very good defense. I don't know that it was ever a dominant defense where it could make plays for the offense. You look at 2011, they scored 5 defensive touchdowns. Mm-hmm. This year, they scored 0 defensive touchdowns.
And you know, I said all year long, they were going to miss, and they did miss Jarrell Worthy. He was such an integral part for that league. He gave them a lot of push up front. And that was the key, and they really missed him. And that's the cornerbacks were on an island all the time. Mm-hmm. So, yes, they made good plays a lot of the times, but sometimes they couldn't make good plays.
Well, when you get push up the middle from the pass rush, that prevents the quarterback from stepping up, and then he's there when the defensive ends come around. Now defensive ends can do their job, and all the quarterback does is just step up in the pocket. Mm-hmm. So that was a big factor. I also think they missed Trenton Robinson.
Yes.
It's hard for me to think that a guy named Robinson could have that much positive effect, but I think it did for Michigan State in 2010 and 2011. But this year that wasn't the case, and they were trying new people back at free safety. I think they also got a couple of bad breaks. And, you know, a lot of things came together. You don't want to keep using the phrase perfect storm, but it kind of was.
It was,
yes. There were just a couple of calls that went the wrong way, and you later saw that those weren't the best calls, but you have to be good enough to play over those.
Right.
You're a great team, and Michigan State wasn't a great team. Was it a good team? Could have been a good team, but right now it is what it is, and that's a 500 football team.
Yes, like you said, they couldn't play over those calls, which they really needed to do, but it was just one of those things where it just didn't come together for them. Now, we look at the basketball team last year. Last year's team, they were a good team, but they weren't a great team either. But, you know, they got to play Louisville, but they made a nice run of the tournament. But do you think that was as far as they should have went, or could you think they could have maybe even got a little further?
Well, they could have gone one game further, but they could have gone one game less, too. You look at the St. Louis game in Columbus, second game of the tournament. Michigan State certainly could have lost that. And they were letting Keith Appling shoot, finally made a play. Draymond Green made a couple plays. It comes down to one or two plays, and sometimes that's the difference. The ball go in, does it hit the rim, does it kick out, does the official call a block or a charge? So many things like that that are discretionary calls. You know, Michigan State lost its first 2 games of the season against North Carolina and Duke, and then came back and won 29 basketball games. That's a lot of games.
Yes, it is.
And went into the Big Ten tournament as a co-champion and won the Big Ten tournament. That's only the 3rd time Michigan State has won the Big Ten tournament. So Michigan State had a phenomenal year, led by one great player and a lot of support players. And now we see when that player is gone, it's not the same. You can have other athletes come in, step in, but the chemistry isn't the same. The leadership isn't the same. Michigan State had a once-in-a-generation player in Draymond Green. Some people's mind, the National Player of the Year. And, you know, they're going to miss him, obviously. And they haven't recovered. They haven't quite filled in all the gaps yet.
And yes, he was such a great leader. And, you know, a lot of times I think we underestimate how important leadership is. And that's such an important part because, you know, you need that from one player. You know, he can lead the other players or at least give them direction. And that hurt them not having a Draymond Green. The other leaders, as we know, they're nice guys. But, you know, are they really leadership material?
Yeah, and I think we have the problem. Not just the media, but we're guilty, too, of looking at stats too much.
Yes.
We say, well, you know, this guy only scored this many points. They can make those points up. But there are so many intangibles, so many things that don't show up. Getting other guys to play better, getting other guys to play with more confidence. How are the minutes distributed? And a guy like Draymond Green was the coach's dream. And now I think Golden State is finding out. He's played a little bit more minutes now. He's healthy. He's going to work his way into the rotation, and I see him being a 10-year NBA player.
Yes, now, that's one thing I wanted to ask you about. You know, Draymond Green, he was a coach's dream. He did everything the coach wanted him to do, and he excelled at it. A lot of players, you know, they want to do their own thing on the court. They don't want to follow the coach's instruction. They don't want to be, quote-unquote, a team player. And yet, a lot of those guys, a lot of people really give those guys a lot of compliments, a lot of accolades, even though they're not really a team player.
Yeah, and that's something I guess you can get better at it, but I don't know if you can ever really be a made leader. Mm-hmm. I think you kind of have those characteristics or you don't. And you see it, people coming up through elementary school, that they tend to be the person who makes the decisions. Everyone gravitates to them. Draymond Green was the kind of guy who back at Saginaw High School was a leader. He's a leader at Michigan State, and he'll be a leader on every team he's on. Right now in the NBA, he's kind of feeling his way. He's trying to figure out what the game's all about. But it won't be long, and he'll be a dominant personality on that team, too.
And you know, we've seen it, and we've said it over the time. Magic was the leader for Judd. And Tom, you know, Mateen was the leader for Tom. That's about 25 years. It might be another 25 years before another leader of that magnitude comes through Michigan State.
Right. And, you know, Tom would talk about it last year toward the end of the season. He got a lot of questions about next year. How are you going to replace Day-Day? How are you going to get the leadership? And he said, well, you know, this will happen, but it doesn't just happen.
Right.
Doesn't just happen. And some programs are very lucky. Some are unlucky. They can go 40 years without a leader like that.
And that's something, I mean, if you get, you have to really, you know, those are so, guys are so special. You have to just relish them and hold on to them when they're here. And, you know, you just won't see that. And Michigan State has been very lucky having leaders like Magic and Mateen, who both got them both a national championship.
Right. And, you know, when you come to a situation like that, there's a lot of luck involved. I keep coming back to this, and it has a little bit to do with the football seasons. Michigan State for 2 years won every close game, was 8-1 in the close games. This year, not so much, 3-5 in close games, played a ton of them. And it's like that in basketball, too. You remember Michigan State with Irvin? They played Ohio State here in Jenison Fieldhouse, 4-4 in the conference. Ohio State was 8-0. Michigan State wins that game in overtime. If they lose that game, or if they lose a game to Iowa that went into overtime, they don't make it into the NCAA tournament. They're not even part of the field, 40 teams in those days. And Michigan State, in 2000, when they won a national championship, played Iowa State in the Palace, and that was a regional final, and that was really the national championship game. Michigan State won that game in overtime. So, you know, one free throw that rims out, and the whole narrative is different.
And you know, when you look at that and you look at the same thing, you know, it's a different take with football and the bowl games, a bowl experience. And Michigan State has been lucky. They've won their last couple of bowl games. But that whole bowl scenario, you know, it just takes on a totally different relevance, doesn't it? When you only have, you know, you don't have a whole big week-in, week-out tournament. But with the bowl games, you know, you just have that one game at the end of the year.
Yeah, Michigan State had been on the other end of that for a decade. It hadn't won between 2001 and 2011. Finally got the win in triple overtime last year against Georgia. And that was a game it certainly could have lost 100 different ways. So it managed to get the win there and now has another chance this year, a sixth straight bowl. I think what you're looking for is stability. You're looking to be in the conversation. You're looking to be part of the equation in the postseason. And then sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, sometimes you get a break, sometimes you get a bad break. So Michigan State is in position to have another winning season, and that is kind of an important point for this team in light of what could have been, all the things that went wrong this year. It seemed like people got down on Michigan State's football program, and you can certainly understand why. But here they are. They're back in a bowl game, and they were close enough that there's no team they couldn't have beaten. Maybe Notre Dame. They were behind 14-3 fairly late in the game, and then Notre Dame got a couple of insurance scores, field goals. But Michigan State was in a position against Ohio State, certainly could have won that game, lost 17-16, and there was a touchdown called back on a bad call. You look at the Michigan game, you have one of the most reliable kickers in school history, misses a 35-yarder. They wind up losing, last-chance field goal. They lose 12-10. So Michigan State was in just about every game it played, and it won three games that way, too. Yeah, Michigan State could have lost to Boise State in the opener, won 17-13. It certainly could have lost at Indiana, was behind 17-0, came back and won 31-27. And, you know, Michigan State, even, believe it or not, and of course the Wisconsin game, when they ended the Badgers' home winning streak, the second longest in the country, and that Wisconsin team, by the way, is in Pasadena. So Michigan State did something there. It was good enough to win those games, but It wasn't good enough to win all of them.
Right.
And that's what it has to do. It has to strive for that kind of consistency.
You know, Jack, there's one thing I've been wanting to ask you, and we talk about it all the time, but how much do those 15 practices during bowl season help for the next year? Coaches always tell us they're going to help the next year. But how does 15 practices in January or December help for the spring game and help for the next football season? Because they make it seem like they do a great deal. 15 practices do a great deal to help for the next year.
You know, I think that's a bunch of bull. I don't think the 15 practices help much. I think teams in those 15 practices are trying to do what? Trying to get ready to go win a bowl game.
Yep.
Coaches get bonuses. It helps in recruiting if you've won that game. They're not sitting out there saying, okay, we're going to take these 15 practices and we're going to get all of our redshirt freshmen some snaps.
Yeah.
They're not doing that. Yeah, they get some. They get a little bit more exposure to it. They get a little more introduction to the system than maybe they've had running other teams' plays. But that's not what it's all about. You know, sometimes the coach speak is pretty thick. You got to cut
it
through
is. It is. And they do it a lot. Because I always wondered about how much really do they help, you know, do they help at all? Or, you know, is it more important to practice in the spring or in just practice in the fall? And how can 15 practices, just 15 practices in the winter, how can that be much help?
Well, I think spring practice helps because you've lost your senior class.
Yeah.
You've got openings. You've got jobs to fill. You've got to get to know who can do it, who can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Let them know what they have to work on over the summer so when they come back for fall camp, they have an understanding, and then you can make a final evaluation. But during this bowl practice stuff, you've still got your current guys there.
Right.
I mean, you're not thinking about 2013. So I think it's overdone.
Yes. And when we know, because as you know, I'm at basketball practices all during the summer. Because I you know, sometimes that can help. But a lot of times I've seen over the summer that a lot of times the basketball team sort of plays like they play in the summer. If they are really casual and haphazard, a lot of times it ends up being a casual and haphazard during the season. But if they're intense and playing really intense during the summer, they have a tendency to play more intense in the fall. You know?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's probably some carryover there, but a lot of it isn't just what that group does. It's the personalities involved. You know, you have some guys who are out there, and they'll play hard if they're playing you in the parking lot.
Right.
And you've got other guys who are casual, and they need to be pushed and prodded a lot. So, again, some of that comes down to leadership. You see during the summer who's going to have a chance to be a leader, who's going to work, who's worked on his game, who hasn't. I think Adrian Payne took a lot of strides over the summer.
Yes.
There's a ways to go. But I think that Michigan State's a very young basketball team. And I think there are a lot of young basketball teams in the Big Ten. We wind up talking about Michigan State here primarily, but in terms of the Big Ten, think about six teams ranked in the top 19. That's one third.
That is, yeah, that's a lot of teams.
That's a lot of teams.
And
you can
really
have a pretty good
year.
Team in the Big Ten and finish fourth or fifth. Now, to most teams, that would be a disappointment. Certainly to Michigan State, that would be a disappointment because the standards are higher.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all a product of expectations.
Yes, because everybody looks, a lot of times I think, I don't know if it's our fault or the fans' fault or maybe probably a combination of both, of expectations, of expecting teams to be better than what they were for the most times. We really have some high expectations, don't we?
We do, and you can understand that. The fans, they're fans. They want the team to be successful. They're hoping it'll be successful. And the media sees one side of it. They get one story. But what we forget is that Illinois is working, too.
Yes.
Iowa's getting better, too. That Northwestern is out there competing. That Michigan and Ohio State aren't going anywhere. And so with all these other teams, you get the same dynamic. And that's why I was so surprised before the season. I didn't know what to do with Notre Dame. I didn't know what to make of Notre Dame when we were going through picks. I didn't understand what Notre Dame would be. I knew they'd have a pretty good defense. I didn't think it would be one of the best defenses I'd seen in recent years. But I remember calling a beat writer who covered Notre Dame on a daily basis. I've known the guy for 25 years. And I said, so how good are the Irish going to be this year? Can they beat Purdue and can they beat Michigan? He said, I don't know. I'm not sure. I said, maybe they can be 7-5. This is a guy who covers them every day. He thought they could be 7-5. Well, something happened, and that team came together, and they won a ton of close games. I mean, they beat Stanford on a bad call. They win a triple overtime game against Pittsburgh. They beat Purdue in a game that they very easily could have lost. They get past Michigan with the help of, six or seven turnovers. So everything fell right for Notre Dame. But going into the season, nobody expected that.
I know I became a lot higher fan of Notre Dame after they beat Michigan and Michigan State. When they beat both those teams, I said, this could be a special year.
Yeah, it did, and they got better. As you saw, they got more confidence. The quarterback, nobody knew about Everett Golson.
Yep.
Could he do it? Coming in the year, people weren't even sure he'd be the quarterback. And here he is, and he's solid for him. He's a threat. So they were able to make the most of their opportunities. I don't think Notre Dame is a great team, just as I didn't think Ohio State in 2002 when Mark D'Antonio was defensive coordinator. That wasn't a great team. It was a very good defense. Great defense, and opportunistic offense didn't beat themselves, didn't make a ton of mistakes, and won all the close games.
Do you think, that's what I was going to ask you, do you think we're at a point now in the history of Michigan State, in the history of their sports, that they need a two-threat quarterback? Is the time come for them to get a guy who can run and pass, run well, pass well, can do both of them? Usually a Michigan State quarterback can do one, but very rarely does Michigan State have a dual threat.
Well, Michigan State's had some guys who could do both. I think Bobby McAllister probably could have done both. I think he was hamstrung to a large degree by the coaching staff. I think Tony Banks was capable of doing both. Dan Enos was effective doing both. Wasn't a world-class sprinter, didn't have a rocket arm, but was very efficient and could hurt you a lot of different ways. But I guess I'm a bad person to ask that question to, Earl, because going back through all the research for the book I did, Heart of a Spartan, I found that Michigan State isn't much different from a lot of other schools.
Yeah.
And I think that philosophically, now, Mark D'Antonio hasn't hired me, so I can say what I want about the program. I believe that you shortchange yourself in college football if you do not have a mobile quarterback. He doesn't have to be Denard Robinson.
Right.
But he has to be able to buy time, get out of trouble, make a play, and keep the defense honest. If you have a guy who cannot run or will not run, now you're playing 10 against 11. And it allows linebackers to do things. It allows coverage to make adjustments. Makes it much tougher. So if I were a coach, especially at a school like Michigan State, where I did not have a dominant offensive line, I didn't have necessarily receivers who were going to go out and be guaranteed to make the NFL, I would have a quarterback who could threaten the defense. I would only recruit dual-threat quarterbacks.
Yes.
The guy would have to be Dan Marino for me to consider signing him unless he could move.
Yes, and that's something that we're seeing more and more of that in the college game, but we just don't see enough of it, overall in the Michigan State game. But we're seeing more of that in college football. And hopefully, Michigan State will eventually one day start recruiting more of these two-threat quarterbacks or dual quarterbacks. But, we just haven't seen it a lot, but we know that's something that's sorely needed in college sports and sorely needed here at Michigan State.
Well, I was critical of the coaching staff a second ago, and now I'm going to go back on that just a little bit, because Kirk Cousins wasn't particularly mobile, but he had a lot of other things going for him. He certainly had Keyshawn Martin, B.J. Cunningham, who could make plays, and Edwin Baker, who could threaten the defense with a quick burst and take it the distance. I don't know that we ever saw the real Andrew Maxwell. I'm kind of hoping we didn't. But remember, he was injured in the spring?
Right.
And William Golston fell on him, and there was some question how he was going to be. I'm not sure he was ever 100%. And plays he would have made. This guy was a 6'7 high jumper.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw that kind of athleticism from him.
I never did either, so yes.
I do know that the guys behind him are fairly mobile. Connor Cook supposedly is mobile. I'm not completely convinced what that experiment's going to be, but I think Tyler O'Connor, the guy they brought in, who redshirted this year, is pretty mobile. I think that in terms of recruits that they're looking at now, they've got some guys coming in who are pretty mobile, dual-threat quarterbacks. So I think those kinds of players are going to have to fit into the system for Michigan State to maximize its potential.
Yeah. You know, Jake, there's one thing that we casually pass on and talk on in football. We never really give it a lot of thought, but we never talk a lot about special teams. Mm-hmm. We mention it from time to time as passing, but we never really talk about it.
Very, very important, Earl. That's a very good point. When you look at what Keyshawn Martin did in the return game, that wasn't there this year. They got one kickoff return early in the season, didn't go the distance, but it gave him pretty good field position. And then Andre Sims had a 40-yard punt return against Minnesota. Other than that, the return game was not good. If you look at the punting game was excellent with Mike Sadler, but Dan Conroy, who was supposed to be an all-Big Ten kicker. I mean, think about this. This guy, as a sophomore, comes out of nowhere. No one had ever heard of him. Everyone said, how are they going to replace Brett Swenson? Yep. They got three guys. He wins the battle, and he misses one kick all year. One kick, the whole year. And then last year, he beats Ohio State with a 50-yard field goal. He outkicks the leading kicker in SEC history in the bowl game. They win the bowl game. And everyone assumes he's going to come out, and he's going to be an NFL kicker.
Yep.
This year, he misses nine kicks. You can't miss nine field goals if you're Michigan State and have a successful season because they're in too many close games.
Yeah, and they're all between the 20 and the 40 for the most part.
Yeah, so they've got to make these. If they're going to go for three, they got to make the three.
That's true.
Otherwise, you're better off going for it.
Yeah.
You and I have had this argument up in the press box.
Yeah.
But I think too many teams kick too many field goals anyway. I think your chances are much better. I think the statistical analyses have shown, Penn State proved it this year, that if you go for it on short yardage and controlled situations, you have more to gain than you do to lose.
But as we know, most coaches don't have the kind of guts.
They don't. And most coaches don't foul when they're up by three in the last seconds of a basketball game either.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, they let a team shoot a three-pointer. Sometimes they make it. Sometimes they don't.
Mm-hmm.
But they're scared to do it the other way, the logical way.
Yep. Yeah, and that's some of the things in sports that we can talk about it in debate, because so many fans, it drives them crazy, too.
Yeah.
And we see that a long, long time. It really drives them crazy if coaches won't go for it or if they won't make the player take a chance at winning a game or at least tying the game or something. I think we all like a coach just to go for it. If it's behind or if it's close, just to go for it. You know, don't play it safe or try to just to win it in a safe way, but just go out and win the game. And I think people would be satisfied with that. Unfortunately, a lot of them don't do that.
Well, I believe in playing the percentages. That's like betting with you. It's a high percentage of success. So that's
yes,
why
it is.
I do it. But in terms of football, the high percentage play is not necessarily the play that you see a lot of coaches do. Because if it doesn't work, there's too much ridicule. There's too much scorn. So they take the safe way. They punt the ball or they kick the field goal. But I think that statistics have shown over and over, and there have been a couple of recent studies on it, that you should be going for it on fourth and short unless you're in your own territory.
Now, we see coaches get a lot, as you say, they get a lot of ridicule, a lot of abuse. But Mark Antonio didn't get much of that this year, even though it was an off year for him. They had an okay season, not a great season, but just an all right season.
Mm-hmm.
So what does he have to do now? Does he have to have a good year this coming year? Will he receive or will the fans still continue to show some patience with him?
Well, I think there are a couple of factors here. One was that they just had the first two 11-win seasons in school history. So he did have some chips to play. He had earned the right to have a somewhat disappointing season. And it's not like they fell off the edge of the earth.
Right.
I mean, a bad year for Michigan State used to be three wins.
Right.
Here, a bad win is a bad season is a bowl season. So it's not like they weren't competitive. If they had lost 40-10, he would have gotten criticism. But, he can't necessarily control every factor that goes on out there. He can't control when an official is going to call a play dead that shouldn't have been blown down. He can't control that. You'd say, he should be able to win regardless. He should be able to win 35-7.
That's what people say.
You know what? It just doesn't work that way. But I do think people gave him a little bit of a leash this year for a couple of reasons. One was they blamed the coordinator for it.
Yeah.
Instead of blaming the head coach. And also they realized that, hey, there were a lot of new people in key positions. There were a lot of injuries they didn't expect. You know, one injury in football can undo everything. And it doesn't have to be an injury to the highest profile guy. Before the Notre Dame game this year, it was 2 days before. It was on a Thursday. Fofanodi, right tackle, was injured. Now, Fofanodi isn't a first-round draft choice. He wasn't an All-American. But he was a guy in that offensive line that they really needed, especially when they were playing a defense like Notre Dame's. And after that, people who were around the program said that team was not the same. Yeah. The offensive line wasn't the same. The attitude wasn't the same. The confidence wasn't the same. And, you know, he missed the whole year. Now he's going to come back. They're going to get a lot of guys back. But they've got a lot to prove. And Mark D'Antonio has something to prove.
Yes. Jack, I mean, when we talk about leadership, leadership really seems to be more critical in football than it is in basketball. There seems like there's always a lot of leaders, a lot of guys with potential leadership in football, whereas you might have one or two in basketball, or a lot of those guys prefer to be the other guy's buddy or be his friend.
Why is that?
And I was wondering that. I was going to ask you that. Why is that? Why do guys in basketball want to be buddy-buddy and friends with all their teammates and such? And in football, they don't mind being the leader and being such, because they had, they had at least five or six leaders in football.
Now, but you got 85 scholarship
players.
Yeah,
that's true.
So if you have five leaders out of 85, you're talking about one out of every 17. Mm-hmm. You don't even have 17 scholarship players.
Yeah.
You know, you probably don't have 17 guys dressed.
Yeah.
So in that case, you've got smaller numbers, and some years maybe you get lucky. You have two or three. Some years you don't have any. Michigan State isn't the only school in that situation.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of schools like that. And with basketball, of course, you always – just about every team looks for leaders or hope they have a leader, but a lot of them just don't have good leaders. They have good players, a lot of good players, but they don't have anyone who wants to be the leader who wants to make his teammates mad.
You know, you can look at a football season and break it down. I've said this before, but if you look at the total number of plays in a game, offense, defense, special teams, all together, you know, you might have 200 plays in a game.
Yeah.
And you have one play go different out of 200. Makes all the difference in the world. People don't look and say, well, that was a close loss. Well, this should happen. It's a win or a loss. It's bottom line. It's zero sum. One wins, one loses. Doesn't matter if you have more yards than the other team. Doesn't matter if you have more time of possession, more first downs. Did you have more points? Were you a success or were you a failure? And in Michigan State's case, too often they came out on the wrong side of that equation.
Yeah, why is that? Why do people place that so much on football? Like, they examine every aspect of the game, and then they look at, well, they just didn't win the game. Everything they did was the wrong thing. It seems like we really break down and analyze football a lot more than the sport of basketball.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think there's more to the game.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got specific time segments. There's a stoppage of play. There's a start and a stop to each play in football. In basketball, maybe you have that with a whistle, with a free throw or something like that, but you can have long stretches. You can go 2 minutes in basketball and keep playing. If there's not an official's call or no foul, ball doesn't go out of bounds, you can go for a long time. So people break it down differently. In football, everything is statistically oriented. It's much more like baseball that way. Baseball is the ultimate.
Yes.
The play starts when the pitcher decides he's going to let the ball leave his hand, mm-hmm. and it ends with a result. There's either it's a ball, it's a strike, it's a foul ball, the ball's hit into play, and then there's a result from that. So I think people have a tendency to break football down.
Yes.
They want to analyze it. They want to look at every specific component of it. But at the end of the day, you can have a pretty good football team and win some close and lose some close games, and you can have a pretty bad football team in some ways and get lucky and win some close games.
Yeah, because in football, we have the advantage of a whole week to either analyze it or break it down. You have a whole week
builds up to go over it.
It builds up. It's almost the perfect sport because you get time to analyze it and break it down and do that for a whole week's time. And and I guess that's good. It probably drives coaches crazy. As you know, coaches are always fired. And that's the thing I would say if I was a coach, I want to get fired because I want to get that buyout clause. Mm-hmm. I would do that. So many coaches now are getting fired, and everybody gets rehired, no matter what they've done, basically. You know, Bobby Petrino's got a job, and some of these other coaches out there, they get second and third chances, and, that's how this sport is.
So how come you didn't go into coaching? You'd have been fired three times by now? You'd be wealthy.
Exactly. I'd be living in – I probably wouldn't –
driving a Cadillac, so that's not going to change.
No, but see, I probably wouldn't even stay. If I got fired the first time, I would have been done. I probably wouldn't have stayed, but so many people, they look at that when coaches get fired, hired, and like Tom Izzo was very lucky to land in Michigan State. He got a great job. He's got it. He almost left a couple of times, as we know,
right.
But he stayed, and I think he made the right decisions on staying. A lot of coaches probably would have left in his situation.
You know, every job, every profession has different advantages and disadvantages. You look at coaching, income potential is high, excitement level, very high, fame, notoriety, high, pressure, very high, stability, very low. You're in a position where, you make a decent living, certainly, but you're going to retire after how many years here?
39 years.
39 years. Mm-hmm. Congratulations. 39 years here, but you have job security. I mean, you would have to do something pretty bad to lose your job here.
Mm-hmm.
Coaching staff.
Right.
Owner doesn't like you. Athletic director doesn't like you. President doesn't like you. The wrong booster doesn't like you. You're gone.
Exactly.
So it's a trade-off. We all make decisions on what we want to do and what we can do. And coaching is one of those things. I coached for 3 years. It's the most fun I ever had. I'd do it again in a heartbeat. But that security isn't there. You can lose. Maybe not your doing.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a bad show or a good show, chances are pretty good you had a lot to do with it. You either planned it well, you executed it well. You can be a football coach and, the quarterback's got a wide open receiver and he throws the ball 6 inches too far. You didn't throw the ball six inches too far. You didn't tell the guy to throw it 6 inches too far. It just happened. The wind took it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many variables. That's why we analyze it all the time.
Or just like with John L. Smith, who, he had a lot of injuries. I mean, if you lose your starting quarterback, you're in trouble if you lose your starting quarterback. And a lot of it is out of your control in football, that's for sure.
Right. And one thing we have seen at Michigan State, keep coming back to Spartans and talk about other things, but one of the things we have seen historically at Michigan State is first-year quarterbacks versus senior quarterbacks. In doing Heart of a Spartan, we went back through and did a pretty detailed historical analysis, and this is not a new phenomenon. You can go back to 1954, Earl Morrill's first year. His completion percentage was about 35%. It was a little between 35 and 40%. Next year, he's an All-American, and they go to the Rose Bowl. You can go to 1964, and Steve Judae, very mediocre year. The next year, he's back in form, All-American, Michigan State, wins the national championship or shares it, goes on to the Rose Bowl. You can look at 1976, Eddie Smith's first year. Tough orientation. They go from Denny Stoll's system to Darryl Rogers' system. They have a losing record. After that, they're off and running, and they set a Big Ten record for the most points. Still stands. You can look at that in the 80s when George's fourth year, Dave Urema was the quarterback, and they had a bad year in 86, didn't make a bowl game. Not a bad year. I mean, they were still 500 or a hair above, but didn't make a bowl game. The next year, what happens? They come out, they win the Rose Bowl. You saw it happen with Nick Saban in 98. You saw it happen with Mark D'Antonio in 2009. So we tend to get an image of a program. And it never changes.
Right.
Well, guess what? Teams change. Programs change. Individuals change. Some get better. Some get worse. But we have to remember that what we saw last year wasn't necessarily what we saw this year. And if you look at Notre Dame, they weren't even ranked in some of the preseason polls. You can look at a lot of Kansas State wasn't highly thought of. They had a great year.
Yeah. Why do you think that We as fans and the media expect, you know, if you had a good year last year, you should automatically have another good year this year, especially if you have all the players back, most of the majority of players back, even though the team will still be different, even if you say you got 15 or 16 players back. Yet, you know, yes, they might get better, but they might get worse. But most of the time, we assume that the players all coming back are going to be better than they were last year.
Okay. This week, 5 days, you're on the air, okay? You got a show every day. Is every show the same?
Nope.
Do you have good shows and shows that you wish you could do over?
Yep.
Yeah. You're the same guy. Mm-hmm. You haven't changed. You didn't take stupid pills. But sometimes you have a show that isn't as good. Sometimes you have a show and you say, you know, that show could be as good as any in the country. You feel differently about it with good reason. So it's the same way in practice. It's the same way in a game. You have good games, you have bad games, you have good years, you have bad years. It doesn't take much for a guy to get 10% better or 10% worse. Sometimes there are injuries we don't even know about.
Right. That's one thing I did want to ask you about. Do you think that coaches, I think we've had this argument before, should be more honest with us in the media and with the fans on talking about the injury factor?
Sure.
I mean, because they never, ever want to talk about injuries until after the season over. We'll hear about all the injuries after the season.
Right.
But during the season, we never hear about the injuries. And, you know, that could be detrimental to them. And it hurts the team. But yet we never hear about it until after the season is basically a long over.
Well, you like the NFL.
Yes.
I like college football for the passion and the pageantry, but I have to hand it to you. You know, the NFL does a lot of things right. They are the best-run professional league, and for a lot of reasons. And one of them is the way that they treat information and the way they handle injuries. The NFL has injury reports.
Yes.
And several times a week, they have to release that information. If you don't release accurate information, you get a big fine from the league. College sports don't do that. But I believe, and this is one of my crazy theories, I believe college sports are cruising for a bruise. I think that sometime in our lifetime, and neither one of us are 20 anymore,
yeah.
Sometime in our lifetime there's going to be a scandal. And it's going to be exactly what college football asked for. Because the only people who know the extent of the injuries are the gamblers.
Right.
They've got runners all around campus, in the dorms, in the apartments, who give them information so they know. You and I don't know.
Yes. But the gamblers,
Gamblers know there's a lot of money changing hands, and whenever you've got a situation like that, you've got athletes who are not fully vested partners. They're not getting big salaries. In fact, they're restricted from earning. Johnny Manziel can't even make a nickel off of Johnny Heisman or Johnny Football or any other name he wants to have. You know, everybody else can profit, but he can't. If he wants to leave, if there's a coaching change, he's got to sit out a year. So the players look at that and they say, you know, maybe we shouldn't be complete, total free agents, free market capitalism, where we can sell our services to the highest bidder. But let us have a stake in the game. And so a gambler comes up to them and says, look, we don't need you to throw the game, but just make it close. You're a 14-point favorite. You're a quarterback. You're a defensive back. You're a kicker. You can exert some control over what happens in this game. So just keep it close, and we'll give you $5,000. We'll give you $10,000. If the money is big enough, they can give you a lot more than that. And I believe we have seen some indications, the start of this, and as more athletes become turned off by the fact that the coaches can make $3, $4 million a year, and their parents can't come to a bowl game, can't come to an NCAA tournament because they can't afford it, show up on campus and they can't get a free meal according to the NCAA rules, you know, they're not fully vested in this. So I think they're going to look out for themselves, and a lot of them are going to be susceptible to gamblers. And the fact that that gambling information is made so valuable by the NCAA's refusal to be honest about it,
right,
it's playing right into their hand.
This program is pre-recorded. Please do not call in. We just heard Sport Magazine editor Jack Ebling discuss Michigan State football. Now we'll turn our attention to Michigan State hockey with MSUSpartan.com staff writer Neil Koepke. This has been an unusual time for Michigan State hockey. They just haven't been scoring many goals this year, or last year, actually.
Well, this year especially, they just haven't had the consistency that they hope to have, Earl, to put themselves into good position to win games. And obviously, you have to score more than two goals a game the way the game is played today. It's certainly more defensive on almost all levels, but it's still a type of game where you'd almost need three goals to ensure that you're going to be a good chance to win the game. 2-1 just doesn't do it unless you're playing so defensive that you never give up any chances and that you smother the opposition and so forth. And Tom Manassas' philosophy is, if he's going to build the program with high-level recruits that like to play more of an up-tempo game, he can't go back to playing defense and just trying to win that way. He has to show that the program is all about pushing the puck, playing offense. And they want to be like the Red Wings, like the Pittsburgh Penguins, the Oilers, like Michigan, Minnesota, these type of teams. And in order to do that, you just have to get your players into that mindset. And even though they don't have all the players to do that now, I still think that's the philosophy. And as much as possible, he's going to try to push the puck and try to score. And sometimes when you don't do that, you give up goals, and it costs you because you're not able to score more than two or three. And I believe that's what's happened for the first 2 months of this season.
Now, is this a problem with they don't have enough goal scorers, or do they just have a lot of guys with potential to score goals?
Well, I think that the talent level up front is okay but not great. There's no question that they don't have the goal scorers now that they're going to try to have to get in the next like 2-3 years with recruiting. And you have to recruit that type. And so I think what happened last year, Earl, in a lot of ways, Torrey Krug, defenseman, really masked some of Michigan State's offensive issues because he was so great at bringing the puck out of the zone and creating offense and then being a dominant player in the offensive zone with his skills, whether it was passing the puck, whether it was shooting, or being on the power play and able to score that, you know, ultimate goal that tied the game, put him ahead, or so forth. Torrey Krug is a big reason why Michigan State went to the NCAA last year. Because if you really look at it, without Torrey or even without his performance at such a high level, which gave him All-America honors, the Spartans would have, like, finished probably not fifth in the league, but sixth or seventh, and never made the NCAA tournament. That's what they're missing this year. If you put Torrey Krug on the Michigan State roster this year, I think they'd be a top 20 team. They wouldn't necessarily be great, but I believe they would have a winning record or close to it. Wouldn't be 4-10-2, would be closer to 500 or maybe above it. And some of those games that they just lost 1-0 or 2-1, 3-2 would have turned into potential victories.
Is this team reflective of the NHL lockout? I mean, is this team showing that because of the lockout, are more players coming to college hockey or getting involved in college hockey, or it doesn't matter?
No, it doesn't have any effect on it because the lockout was something that just happened to happen over the summer. And whether they played and went to camp, signed a deal and went to camp, or they didn't, the players that were out there were going to come to college and so forth. What the lockout might have done necessarily is kept some kids in school that might have thought about coming out. But I think that's only a handful, and certainly not any part of Michigan State's roster would have like been more apt to turn pro if they knew exactly there was going to be not a lockout or stay in school because of a potential lockout.
Does Michigan State recruit many of the older hockey players like we've seen Ferris State do and a few other colleges? They get the older players out of the minors, the other leagues.
Well, they used to. Under Rick Conley, they did grab lots of 19 and 20, 21-year-olds, which is why right now on Michigan State's roster, there's three players there that I think are turning 24. And in the past, there's been a couple 25-year-olds that never started school until they were 21. And those are the diamonds in the rough, the kids that basically developed late, went to junior hockey, stayed eligible for college hockey. And when they were looking for a place to play, Michigan State and other schools came calling. Rick Conley at Northern did that a lot just to get his foot in the door on some of the best talent. And when you're recruiting like at a Lake Superior State or a Northern, Michigan Tech, and a lot of other schools, Ferris, as you mentioned, I would think that that is what they do look for. They're not going to get the 16, 17, 18-year-old that commits early. They're going to get the kids that are sort of left over. And with all the big hitter schools basically making their commitments early, there's room for these kids that are basically late bloomers. And still want the college education and remain eligible to do it. At Michigan State, basically, it's not as much of an 18-year-old recruit anymore like it used to, but it's at least 19 and then occasionally a couple 20-year-olds. But it goes back and forth. I think in the long run, with Tom getting commitments from more high-level elite players from the Detroit area and in and around Canada or whatever, I think you'll see more 18- and 19-year-olds coming to the fold as opposed to 20- and 21-year-olds to start.
Where would you say Michigan State hockey is right now? Are they just trying to gather more players and better younger players? Where would you say they'd be at right now?
Well, on the spectrum of things, when Tom came in to look at the program, it obviously is about taking the team you have and winning now. And he did that. And last year was an amazing season from the standpoint of Tom in September, October, when the seasons first started. He had no idea who was going to be the leaders, who's going to be the scorers, the defensemen. It was a very new thing just from the fact that he'd never coached those guys and he'd seen very little on tape. But he wanted to be fair and say, every job is open, and I'm not going to look at tapes from last year's games when you were with another coach, another system. I want to see what you can do now. And so what he saw was a team very limited in skill, but one that was hungry to win because they'd never won before. And so for him to develop that team into a consistent group that played hard, worked in the corners, battled, and played pretty good defense, and then got good goaltending, and like I said before, used the Torrey Krug influence of offense, that was able to max some of their deficiencies on offense and even on defense, because it wasn't a great defensive team, but they played a good style, a very cognizant game in their own zone. And when they did get the chance, they moved the puck and they developed some skills. Yes, Greg Wolf, Lee Reimer, Matt Barry from last year probably scored more than Tom ever thought. But it was necessary because those were the guys that needed to blossom. Those guys are still there and they're the ones that are being counted on now too. But I think more than anything, Earl, the day-to-day operations are about winning and making this team as good as it can. But every day also leads to what the program needs to be about as far as the structure, practice, as far as the tradition, the history, and so forth. But it really is a long-range goal that the Spartans have to get back in the top five, compete for a national title. But like any transition, when you come in as a new coach and you're using the players that were there, and if you can say those players sometimes are elite players when things leave itself. In Michigan State's case, they weren't elite players. They were pretty good kids, pretty good workers, and what you need to do then is start supplementing in the recruits. I think on this team, Tom has about five or six recruits, but I would only call maybe one or two elite. The other guys are basically role models, character kids that he knows from the Detroit area that needs to be on your third and fourth lines to be a depth player. And eventually those guys will be an integral part of the team. But it's going to take about two more years before the elite level players arrive, because recruiting, as in basketball, Earl, and a little bit in football, but not so much, they're recruited out by 3 and 4 years. Verbal commitments right now with Notre Dame, they have 20 verbal commitments going over starting in 2013, 14, and 15. And they might even have a 2016 kid in there. So you're talking like sophomores and juniors that are still in high school that still have a couple of years to go. But that's how far recruiting is out. So for Tom to get the best kids, he's got to go in there, and he just can't start this year, next year. He's done that in a little bit with some high school kids, some kids that have turned out to be very high-level prospects. And I think next year we'll see three good forwards come to this school that will probably make a big impact and start to change that offensive turnaround into more victories. And in 2 years, Earl, there's going to be like three elite-level defensemen, and I'm talking like NHL-style defensemen that will be on this campus that have been already verbally committed, haven't been announced, of course, because you can't do that. But that's when things will change. So maybe another year in the middle of the pack of the league. And then after that, I think the program takes off with just a higher level of talent.
This is Michigan State University Radio, AM 870, WKAR, East Lansing.
Thanks for listening to Sports Talk with Earl Robinson from AM 870 WKAR.